So anyway, today I thought I'd talk about, and then the other thing I should say is, in the 2D crystallography, most of the things that I'll tell you about are programs that Joyce Baldwin and I wrote some years ago, and we still take care of them and advise people and so on, but most of our own work now is trying to focus on what we can do new in the single particle area. Although, whatever you do in electron microscopy does have repercussions for any specimen you work on, because most people now are doing electron cryomicroscopy, and then, you know, how you measure your data, how you process it, so there are many things in common. So if you find a new way of doing something, like preparing a specimen, collecting data computationally, that you get from one of the approaches, it could well be that it can be used to improve the others as well. So I think there is an advantage, not in becoming a kind of purist, but in keeping a bit of an interest, even if you're not doing it yourself, in the other areas, because you might well be able to pull things in. Anyway, so today I thought I'd go over what we've done and what we do currently. And of course, those of you who I've given talks and had the pleasure of having you in the audience before, which I recognize a number of people, will have seen some of these slides, but I reckon there would be enough people that hadn't seen them that, you know, there would be some benefit. So the first, roughly about half of the talk, shows you some of the things that some of you will have seen before. And then I'll go on and talk about some of the things that are unsolved still in the electron crystallography area and what we might do about them. And then end by wondering whether or not some of the things that we actually do and are needed and we know they're important in electron crystallography, but which we know are not being used at the moment by people in other areas, which things can be, ought to be, transplanted from this area into other areas and aren't being done at the moment. Okay, so starting over with just an overview then of what is 2D crystallography. We've worked on a number of different systems, but all the development was done with this protein, bacteria rhodopsin. And one thing I forgot was one of these pointers, actually. this is a freeze fracture picture that Walter Stickinius, who worked for about, or still is there, 30 years up in UCSF, took when they first discovered these little patches, which are 2D crystals of bacteria rhodopsin. And I started working on these about 1973 or so. And it took us a few years to get a sort of low-resolution structure, and then more like 15 until we had a high-resolution structure. But those methods now are the methods that we use and have been used in a few other cases of 2D crystals. Great, Clint. Thank you very much. So if you take these bacteria, you can isolate the membranes, and this is another of a shadowed picture taken by Stickinius. And the membranes, they come from the bacteria, so they have an inside and an outside, and depending on how they sit down on the mica surface, and these have been shadowed with platinum carbon, they interact with the carbon differently, and half of them get no cracks and they look nice and smooth, and that's the ones we think that have the extracellular side in contact with the carbon. They have sugars there. And the others attach very strongly and then they crack when they dry. So you get a picture of the two sides, but there's no structure in them. They're just completely smooth because you're looking at the carbon replica. But you can then put them on a carbon grid without any platinum carbon, and these are then embedded in a very thin film of sugar, or there are other things you can use. So this is a little puddle of what will become, was 1% glucose, and is now a little, so 50 angstroms of glucose on either side of a 50 angstrom. So the membranes are quite nicely preserved, and then the carbon hasn't wetted. So you can then pick out one of these membranes, and all the molecules in it are in a nice 2D crystal. So when you take a picture of them, the signal you get build up just like in the signal in X-ray diffraction pattern or other kinds of diffraction. And so the two kinds of data that we collect if we want to find the structure of the molecules that are in those 2D crystals are electron, well, there will be electron diffraction patterns, but we'll The two types of data that we collect are diffraction patterns, which is this sort of dotted plane here, indicating a piece of film being put in the diffraction plane, and here a slightly under-focused image, and this gives you the diffraction amplitudes of the spots from the crystal and the amplitudes and phases. So it's a schematic of an electron microscope. Here is a nice, pure, chromatic electron beam. Here is the specimen, so part of one of the grids. The beam comes through it. Many of the electrons are not scattered. Some of them are scattered, coherently and incoherently. And really, we're not really using the inelastically scattered electrons, which contribute to the background. But the elastically coherent scattering ones form, if you collect them and focus them back with a lens looking in the diffraction plane, you get the direct beam, and then all the diffracted orders would be in the diffraction pattern there. If you go further down in the microscope, the specimen has the image plane down here, but in the electron microscope, if you collect all the electrons that are scattered, and they are all scattered, and even the ones that lose energy don't lose much energy, so in the end, they're all scattered back, unless they're scattered at a very high angle. And if you have an in-focus image, it doesn't have any contrast in it. So there are sophisticated ways of getting contrast, but the easiest one is just to have the image slightly out of focus, and then the diffracted beams that are scattered come back, and they don't quite reach the place where they would have come from. So you have an out-of-focus image, and again, I'm not going to go into the theory of where the contrast or the contrast transfer function and so on, but we can talk about that, or, you know, lots of textbooks, and the theory has been worked out for a long time. And in biology, we're not doing anything fundamentally different from what's been known about electron microscopy for a long time. So these are the two sorts of picture that we take. If this wasn't a 2D crystal, you could still try to collect the diffraction pattern. But since there wouldn't be spots, it would be a continuous diffraction, there'd be a lot of carbon film, you can't focus the beam on the specimen, so the diffraction patterns for non-crystalline specimens are more or less useless, and people don't use them. But the image would contain all the image information, regardless of what the specimen would be. So this diagram, then, would be exactly how you'd think about electron microscopy. And electron cryomicroscopy, you just have the specimen cold, say below the ice transition temperature between amorphous ice and crystalline ice, so liquid nitrogen, liquid helium temperature. What you'd be doing in this diagram would be exactly the same, whether you're taking pictures of single particles in ice, thin sections, tomographic thin specimens, helical arrangements, or 2D crystals. You'd be taking a somewhat under-focused, slightly out-of-focus image. And what they look like, well, here's an electron diffraction pattern taken from one of these bacteriodopsin crystals, from which we've subtracted all the inelastically scattered electrons, which would normally give you quite a background in the middle. But that background is sort of radially symmetric. So the computer program that displays this simply finds what the radial average scattering is, and then subtracts that from each pixel, making sure that things that are more than 2 or 3 sigma differing from that radial background, like the spots, or things like the backstop. We have a backstop in here, because although a piece of film you can put in, and the direct beam on the film doesn't spread its density very far, if you have an electronic detector like a CCD, and you put, let's say, the strongest spot here might be 100,000 times weaker than the main diffracted beam, that would overload most of one of the CCD detectors. So often you'll see a backstop used to block out the direct beam in an electron diffraction pattern if it's been recorded with an ARRI detector. So this was a CCD built in the lab in Cambridge by Wasi Faruqi, but very similar to the CCDs you can buy now from Gitan or Tietz. And what you see is the diffraction spots going out to the edge, and if you look, they go out to 2 angstroms or so. So you know you've got a really good crystal here, and that all you need is to take a picture of it, and you should get from the image then both the amplitudes, the same amplitudes that are giving the electron diffraction, and by image processing the phases. And But it doesn't work quite as well as it ought to do, and I'll go into that a bit more tomorrow. Here is an optical diffraction pattern from exactly the same kind of crystal. And although here you can see, for example, this is a sort of 9 angstrom spot. So here would be sort of 2 angstroms at the edge. The equivalent to that spot is something like, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4. This would be the same 9 angstrom spot. And you can see they're getting fainter by the time you get out a bit further. We'll come back to that. But in the images then, which are taken at somewhat higher dose, the diffraction spots fade out more quickly than the electron diffraction patterns. But still the data is there. So the way we... And this is a comparison of an electron diffraction pattern on the right and an image on the left with... And they've been mirrored, so the symmetry of this crystal is P3, which means it doesn't have a mirror. But these have been printed so that you have a sort of row of spots from the electron diffraction, and then the same row of spots that are coming from the image. And on the electron diffraction pattern, you can see if you go out from the center here, that would be the sort of 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, and so on. Oh, no, sorry, wrong row here. 5th, 6th, 7th. 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and then out to 15 or 16 orders. Whereas if you go out on the same direction, they've faded before that. And, see, I've left it in now. If you compare now those amplitudes, so for example, if you take, this would be the intensity in a diffraction pattern, electron and optical. If you measure the amplitude of one of these spots, like the 7O, and compare it to the 7O from the image, and then plot it as a ratio, as a function of the resolution. This is the image amplitude divided by the electron diffraction amplitude. And if you like, the electron diffraction amplitude, apart from a little bit of radiation damage causing it to fade out, is a measure of how strong the diffraction intensity of that Fourier component is. Whereas the image amplitude is telling you how much of it you've managed to record in the image. And you see, as you go out in resolution, 7 angstroms, 5 angstroms, 3.5, and then beyond, you can see that the amplitudes are fading. And these three curves are examples of sort of the improvements over time historically. So this first one here, which sort of fades out at 7 angstrom, is a sort of reprocessing of the best electron micrograph that Nigel Unwin took in 1974 or 1975, of this purple membrane bacteriodopsin, when Nigel and I spent about a year and a half getting going on this and did as well as we could with specimens that were not cryo. They were at room temperature on a Phillips 301. And you can see all the spots, but you've faded out by this a factor of 3, 10, 30. So this is about 100 times these spots here are about 100 times weaker than the lower resolution ones in amplitude. So that means they're 10,000 times weaker in intensity. So you've blasted this specimen, and for one reason or another, it's lost a lot of the power that were in the diffraction spots. And that meant that with room temperature image processing and treating them as all perfect little crystals, you could get to about 7 angstrom resolution, and by tilting, you can get it in 3D. And then with time, commercial cold stages and individuals building their own have made better cold stages. And this one was a picture about 2 years later, taken by Fritz Semlin in Berlin, who had an early liquid helium microscope made by Siemens. And with that, we could get out to almost 3.5 angstroms resolution. And then this is the best one he ever took. In Berlin. So it was liquid helium. We managed to get to 2.8 angstroms. And we thought that in those days, that's what X-ray crystallographers said they needed in order to do an atomic interpretation. 2.8 was the gold standard. The people who went beyond were essentially, you know, being rather too perfectionist, we thought. So we thought 2.8 was good enough. And it would be possible, actually, to go beyond that if you wanted to on specimens that are good enough. But it does show that the data that we're getting isn't as good as it should be. It should be out here. And what we really need in EM, and we'll come back to this tomorrow, is a sort of quantum leap forward in the quality of the data that we get. And let's say, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, all of these were taken before 1990, actually, these pictures. So you can take similar ones now in a much more routine way, but they're not a lot better. And the big change that's happened in X-ray crystallography is we've had third generations of synchrotrons, and then the X-ray people also started to freeze their specimens, which gave them a factor of 1,000 or so in radiation. So they've had quite a big quantum step forward in the last few years, which means that there's a lot you can do now by X-ray diffraction of tiny little crystals that you couldn't do 15 years ago. And so what we really need is a bit of a quantum leap forward in EM, and that would affect crystallography, helices, single particles, and so on. And I think that, you know, we need a few people to work towards that. Anyway, that's a little bit about data. So if you take the data from the images, which and the diffraction patterns, and I'll show a little bit more about how we do that. This is meant to be just a sort of pictorial demonstration of what we do with the images. So these would be images recorded on film and then digitized. And then, of course, the thing about, you can have hairs in your CCD, of course, as well. But you can have hairs in two ways in your film. You can either have a hair in the electron microscope, in which case the electrons don't get to the film, or you can have a hair in your film scanner, in which case the grains were there, but you didn't measure them. And I can't quite remember which way around this was printed, but I expect it's in the densitometer because it's slightly out of focus in the middle. But anyway, the rest of it is the noise from the film grains from the electron dose, which is something like 5 or 10 electrons per square angstrom. And then on each pixel, you might have something like 10 or 20, a small number of electrons. So you have a fairly high noise level, and you cannot see any of the signal that you can see by optical diffraction or by electron diffraction from the fact that your specimen is crystalline. If it was a thicker specimen with crystals of viruses, you probably would see them because there'd be enough contrast. But these are thin crystals, a relatively small protein. So you can't see anything there. And these four steps are basically the four steps that are involved in crystallographic image processing, which are probably similar to single particles. But if you take an optical diffraction pattern or a computed diffraction pattern of these images, you'd get what was shown on this last slide, or two couple of slides ago. You get the diffraction spots, and then the noise that you see here gives you a complete homogeneous background, which you can filter out by reciprocal space filtering. And that picture at the bottom there is a simple picture, this micrograph, from which the random noise, the parts that are not at the Fourier points at the crystallographic diffraction spot, have been removed, and the contrast has been left the same. And you can see here, you can see the periodic image of the crystal, but it's about 10 times weaker than the noise there. And that's because the nature of the scattering and the radiation damage and so on means that for a protein of this size, the noise is about 10 times bigger than the signal. So we just enhance it by a factor of 10, bring it onto the same contour level. And what you have there is the image that underlies this noise in the micrograph that comes from the 2D crystal. But the contrast in it isn't a direct representation of the image. It's been multiplied in reciprocal space by the contrast transfer function, which comes from the defocus. And again, you can look into the nature of that, but it means that half of the Fourier components are recorded with positive contrast and the other half with negative, with a variation between plus and minus one. So you can't really look at this either, but you can correct it in reciprocal space, which is what's done in the third panel here. And so that then is a contrast transfer function corrected picture of this filtered raw image. And in this, you can almost see the molecules, except there's a bit of noise and the amplitudes of the Fourier components aren't as accurate as they would be if you were to take electron diffraction patterns, which give you, from a bigger area, because we use bigger areas for electron diffraction, much more accurate amplitudes. And so the top panel then is essentially the same as the second top one, but we've substituted the image amplitudes with more accurate electron diffraction amplitudes and averaged it with the crystallographic symmetry, which is threefold. So that top picture then is essentially a nearly perfect representation of the projection structure that you get in the micrograph of the crystal that you've taken, the raw micrograph. So you can then apply the same thing to the whole image, and then this display program has the thing, if you click on it, you get a kind of magnified view. So, although it doesn't look very high resolution, each of those pixels is about 1.5 angstroms, and that would be, that's essentially one molecule of bacteriodopsin at atomic resolution. It looks a bit fuzzy and a bit poorly sampled, but all the information is there in that one projection. And you can switch then from this raster display to a contouring method, which is what, you know, most of the, and then one molecule is this sort of slightly pinkish outline. So there's a P3 symmetry with some lipids separating the trimers. You can make it bigger. You can then go into three dimensions with taking pictures of in different directions by tilting the specimen. And again, I won't go into the sort of details of that, but the principle is the same in 2D crystals or in single particles. You're combining different views from different directions in reciprocal space, and we do it in reciprocal space because when you take this defocused images, there are certain regions of reciprocal space which have no contrast. So it goes from positive through zeros to negative. And if you don't do it in reciprocal space, you'll be combining the different data from the different micrographs with the wrong weights. By doing it in reciprocal space, you get a weight of +1 at a maximum, -1 at a minimum, and if there's no signal there for a particular Fourier component, it goes in with no weighting. So you then integrate up all the data, and then you have a 3D transform and a 3D structure. And then that integrated transform and structure, this would be what some of the diffraction spots would look like. So, for example, in the earlier pattern I showed with all the diffraction spots, if you take one of the spots and look at the intensity of that spot, say the 2-8 reflection, in the untilted direction would have a certain amplitude. And then as you tilt, you're tilting all the atoms and parts of the molecule, looking at different directions in the structure, and the amplitude of the Fourier components will vary as you tilt it in different directions. And what this is a plot of all the data from about 70 or 100 different micrographs plotted out as a function of the tilt angle for that spot. So essentially in the Z direction in reciprocal space, this is a picture where they've all been rotationally averaged. So this would be the in-plane resolution, say from here, and this would be the vertical resolution. And the angle here means that we've started with untilted micrographs like the one that I showed you, and then you tilt up 10, 20, 30. And so a 60-degree one would sample it. So you're missing part of the transform. And in 2D crystals, actually different people give up at different stages. So we gave up at 60 degrees for diffraction. We gave up at 45 degrees on imaging because it gets harder and harder. But Yoshi Fujiyoshi, who has much more of a sort of rigorous Japanese approach, I think they went up to, 70 degrees. And Ken Taylor, who might read it, there he knows, not on an unstained thing, I have to say. They once went with a cell wall from Sulfolobus up to 85 degrees by bending the grid and so on, and it was negatively stained. But the pictures you get, they are sort of magnificent to behold. It's like a moonscape, because it's kind of black and white, just like the astronauts in Apollo looking over the surface of the moon at about a 5 degree. So up here is there's a lot of data that would be good to have, but you can get away without it. And of course, the amount of work to get this would be far more than it is to get that. So you just have to cut your losses. And that's why perhaps the single particles will, and the helices, where you get all the views in one or two micrographs, are better. But these two diffraction spots and their variation of dead sort, for 1/6, for example, is one of these, about sort of 1 to 2. So if you go up one of these lines where you've got a lot of power at about 5 angstroms, so you go up here, so it's that line, and then the 2-8 is a bit further over in one of these Of course, all of the spots have been plotted radially here. But you can see there's quite strong diffraction up here. And of course, if you go to 70 degrees, you get a bit more of the diffraction, because most of the structure of most of the membrane proteins have alpha helices. And this is the transform of all the alpha helices. So you have the 10 angstrom packing of the helices side by side. You have the 5.4 angstrom periodicity of the helix. And you see that in the transform of it. So putting together in that 3D way, eventually you get a map. And we've tried to design all the programs we've written to dovetail into all the existing programs. So for example, all the electron diffraction image processing and merging the data and amplitudes and phases end up with data in a format with HKL amplitude and phase that's the same format that the X-ray crystallographers use. So that although you're starting off with different technology, different crystallography, you're ending up with in our case, files that are called MTZ files, which fit in with the CCP4 X-ray system. You can then transplant it into others. You can then use the X-ray programs to calculate the maps, the visualization programs that are used for X-ray crystallography to visualize the maps, to build the models, and so on. And so you've only had to write those programs that are specific for the electron microscopy, and you've fitted in to take advantage of everyone else's and made as much common ground as possible. You can if you want to see. Anyway, this is something like a 5 angstrom slice of the map, and it in principle looks just like a map you'd get with X-ray crystallography. It's only 3.5 angstrom resolution. Here are the helices, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There are also densities hanging off them that represent the side chains. And the only difference is in X-ray crystallography, the map you get represents the electron density because the X-rays are scattered off the electrons. But in the electron microscope, the electrons are charged and they get scattered by the potential. And that potential is inside the atom, so it's positive. So apparently the average inside a protein is about 6 volts. So in a way, this is a map of the potential, but truncated to 3.5 angstrom resolution. So it's a few volts inside it. But actually, since the nuclei are at the center of the atom and the voltage is around it and the electrons are around them, to a first approximation, you can just forget all that and just look at the density. So then you can put in your model. So that, for example, that density turns out to be a tryptophan, this one a tyrosine, another tyrosine, phenylalanine, and so on. And then there are side chains that are leucines. And at this resolution, one of the main things is you're never quite sure which of the rotamers on things like leucine. So it turns out in the end, once things have been done at higher resolution, and this is now about 20 bacteriodopsin crystal structures from a variety of both electron and X-ray crystallography, turns out that a dozen or so of our rotamers weren't quite right. But nevertheless, you can get a model. And so this is a helix with the chromophore retinal in it, side chains around it. You can have an overview of the model with extracellular side, cytoplasmic side, the retinal in the middle. And this, for those who are interested in bacteriodopsin, shows the channel from the... This is the protonated shift base, channel leading to the cytoplasm, channel leading to extracellular side. These are the amino acid residues that are involved in the mechanism, which I'm not going to go into. The most recent thing that we did, mainly Sriram Subramanian's work, was to work out the crystal structure, mainly by electron diffraction, of a mutant of bacteriodopsin. So the purple is the ground state, the yellow is a mutant. We collected something like 3 angstrom resolution diffraction data, and this mutant was selected to have a chain structure that closely resembles the structure of one of the intermediates in the photocycle. And mainly what you see are the top of 2 of the 7 helices. So this one here, helix 6, has moved by about 3.5 angstroms. So this purple to yellow movement, and the top of the 7th helix about 2 angstroms, something like that. So 2 of the helices move and open up a region in the middle of the channel, the cytoplasmic half channel, and that's part of the proton pumping mechanism. Not the only part. You need retinal structural changes. There are other things that are involved, but I've chopped this bit out of what would have been a bacteriodopsin talk, and we want, you know, people can ask about that later, and we're going to move on to second part of it. So that's meant to give you a view of what we did on bacteriodopsin and an explanation of some of the steps that have been involved. And although they are programmed in a specific way, in principle, with the contrast transfer function, the different tilt angles and so on, the approach is quite the same in other kinds of electron microscopy. So there's a lot of things you can carry over. So I just agreed to write a sort of mini review for quarterly reviews of biophysics. Ron will remember the name of this journal, because he's writing one too. And we're all looking forward to see it. Anyway, so what I tried to do was to kind of give an overview by looking at what other people have done in 2D, helical, and so on, aiming at electron cryomicroscopy towards the sort of atomic resolution end of the spectrum. And these are all the things that all the structures that I found people have published that are beyond about 8 or 9 angstrom resolution using 2D crystals. And the ones with asterisks are the only 6 where the resolution was good enough for people to build atomic models. And when they first came out, actually, the X-ray crystallography community was some way behind, I'd say. But now, all of them have now also been... Someone got a crystal by hook or by crook of these various things. So bacteriodopsin, there were 3D crystals long before we were doing high resolution on 2D, but none of them were very good. There were lots of them low resolution, different problems. But finally in 1997, there was the first good enough crystal to get a structure for bacteriodopsin. And I'll show a picture in a little while, but that was from the cubic lipidic phase people, Eva Pebe-Perula and the other group, Ehud Landau and Jörg Rosenbusch in Switzerland and Grenoble, did get a bacteriodopsin structure, and then they used the coordinates from the electron crystallography to plug into their structure. And although the current X-ray structures for bacteriodopsin, the ones that you'd look at if you were wanting to know the structure and so on, they're all very good. I should let you into the little secret that the actual coordinates, which are the most referred to paper on X-ray crystallography of bacteriodopsin, which is the 1997 paper, Pebe Perula et al., represent coordinates that have been degraded rather from the, you know, in other words, they took the electron crystallography coordinates, plugged it in, did rotation translation searches, and then a quick refinement, allowing the atoms to go wherever they wanted, and then published it and deposited them. So you can go back and look and see how good they are. And compared now to the sort of global average of the world's view of bacteriodopsin, this one is now further away from that average than the ones they started with. But nevertheless, because it was the first crystal, they deserve a lot of credit for doing that. And they did improve things. So a year or two later, you know, they sort of recovered their position as having done good work. And there are other bacteriodopsin crystals. But recently, you may have seen in Nature, there's a Japanese 3D crystal of an icosahedral crystal form of LHC2. It's not quite the same in that I think this originally was from peas, and the one from the X-ray is from spinach, but you know they are 95% identical. And actually the resolution is not a lot different. May even be a little lower. But still there is an X-ray structure of it. So whereas you could have said that here was a structure which hadn't been solved by X-ray crystallography, now you can't say it. Tubulin, which is Ken Taylor's work at Berkeley, with Eva Nogales and Sharon Wolfe, which gave for the first time an alpha-beta structure for tubulin in two-dimensional sheets of tubulin. There are now not pig brain tubulin, but a bacterial tubulin that has an actual alpha-beta. It's a very unusual bacterium, and you get it by searching the database and so on, of genome sequences. And Jan Loewe in LMB in Cambridge, has now got an alpha-beta tubulin dimer in a filament, in an X-ray structure. And actually, of course, the structure is, you know, largely the same. But again, there is an X-ray structure for the tubulin. And similarly, the aquaporins, there may be particular species that are only done by electron. But what you can argue is now that you may be 8 years ahead or 2 years ahead, but eventually, if you've got a well-behaved molecule that doesn't fall apart, you ought to be able to make 2D crystals or 3D crystals. So then it's a question of what you want to learn. And pretty soon you ought to be able to do NMR as well. And I think it'd be very nice to have the same structure by each of the three methods. And there will be differences, and I'll come back to that. But anyway, there are a number of others in here, which are still, there are structures, but at lower resolutions only available by EM. So I think we do need a sort of quantum leap forward, and hopefully that will come in a little while. Okay, so I thought now I'd just go over a few topics, and then obviously I'd be here for 2 or 3 days, and if people are particularly interested, we can go into it in more detail. So it'd be more of a superficial look at it. I picked out three things, and obviously there are many more that are terribly interesting technical details, mathematical ways of doing things. But I thought there are ways of committing sins in NMR, X-ray crystallography, or electron microscopy. And one of the things you can get wrong, which makes you look a bit silly, and actually indeed it is silly because you should have been more careful, is if you get the space group wrong, or if you get twinning that you didn't know about, and then you publish the paper. And actually, that's one of the reasons the cubic lipidic phase, they did not realize they had twin crystals. But you can get twin crystals with electron microscopy too. And so people have made mistakes, including ourselves. So I think it's this business about what is the space group? Is it twinned? Is there disorder? There are infinite numbers of different kinds of disorder. And there are infinite numbers that affect X-ray crystals as much as they affect 2D crystals with electron microscopy. So it is useful beyond the idea of turning the handle. You know, you've got your protein, you've made a crystal, and you're going to find the structure. And that's actually what you want to do. But it's worthwhile being aware that there are various pitfalls that are equivalent to sort of making a big mistake. You know, one of the things that makes us now think that NMR is a really good method is that there was, at one time, a structure that was done both by NMR and X-ray crystallography. And the X-ray crystallography structure was complete rubbish. Similarly, there have been NMR structures that have been wrong. But it will come, I'm sure, we haven't had one that's been completely wrong by electron microscopy. But as things spread out and people get nearer to the edge of what you can do, I'm sure there will be one. Anyway, I'll tell you a couple of things about our own almost falling down the pit situation. So, first of all, space group and twinning, first of all. So, in two-dimensional crystals, there are, fortunately, only 17 space groups that you can have that a protein, that's something with some asymmetry in it, can take up. There are actually 80 two-dimensional plane groups, if you like, that have two sides to them. But 63 of them have got molecules in them that have a center of symmetry. So in other words, not a protein. So you can only have 17. And these are the space groups. And they can be corresponding to particular 3D space groups, so that if you want to do a Fourier synthesis using one of the 2D crystals, you can just use the 3D Fourier programs, defining your third unit cell dimension as something that you've chosen, like 100 angstroms or 500 angstroms. So we can go from 2D into 3D. Sometimes there is a choice of axis. So for example, here is a two-sided plane group, which you could call P2, and I'll tell you a little bit about this symmetry in a moment. That means that the twofold axis there is perpendicular to the plane of the membrane. But you can also have P2, That's a space group with a twofold in it, in which the twofold is parallel to the plane of the membrane. So your molecule consists of alternate molecules turned upside down. And they're quite different geometrically because of the relationship between the twofold and the plane. And that would be called P21 and P12. But actually, if you make an artificial cell, they're the same symmetry. But in the 3D, these would be called up as being P2. And with the convention for naming the axes, this would be C-axis and B-axis unique, but with different projection symmetry. So there are things that have the same space group in 3D, but we refer to it because of the relationship to the plane of the fact that it's a 2D in a different way here. And we'll come on in a moment. But for example, if you take, well, let me go on. So if you take this space group, P4212, that means it's a primitive lattice rather than a centered lattice. So and that's the same in 3D and 2D. It means that there's a fourfold axis perpendicular to the plane of the membrane. It means there's a twofold screw axis parallel to the plane of the membrane. And it means that there's another twofold at a different angle, which might either be a 90 degree different angle here in the rectangle, or in a square one it would be at 45 degrees. And this nomenclature, where you have a small p rather than a big P being a 3D space group, small p being a 2D one. When we started with this 2D crystals, all of the programs were written specific for a particular space group. So we had a P3 program and then a P4, somebody came along with a new crystal, you need a new program. And about 20 years ago, Steve Fuller, who was a student for about a year in the lab, wrote a program that tried to put them all together. And of course we copied them from the 3D, and we thought, well actually, wouldn't it be nice if we had our own nomenclature? And we were in the process of inventing this when we discovered there was a paper in 1958 from a German, this is back into the, a mathematical crystallographer. And he actually, we had our own, and we'd actually written a draft of a paper, and we were thinking of sending it somewhere. Got a new nomenclature of it. And it turned out it was so similar, we decided that, it would be better to adopt the nomenclature that had already been invented. So this was his paper. And it's purely mathematical. And these are sort of his rules. So, this is a primitive lattice with a threefold perpendicular and no other symmetry. This is a fourfold perpendicular, a twofold screw parallel to the in-plane axes, and a twofold at 45 degrees. And his nomenclature, of course, covers all 80 and not just the 17. But it is a good one. And then, so we had all these programs, each one separate, and then Steve Fuller wrote one that was integrating them all together. But still, you had to know your space group. You had to tell the program what space group you wanted. And as time went on, less people who were from the physics and mathematics community were working on this. More biochemists and biologists came in. And then we got sort of closer to the edge, beyond which there was the pit into which we've... And actually, we realized about 10 years ago, we really ought to have a computer program that took some of the knowledge and background skill out of it and just told you what your space group was. So this is the program that there's a guy called Jose Valpuesta who came from Spain. Anyway, we wrote this one, and it has in it, as part of the header, it has all the relationships between the different HK and minus HK and so on, and tells you how the phases of the different reflections are related. So this table then, it sort of has educational value in that it integrates what you get from all the other papers. The program that it runs, this little program called AllSpace, actually does it in this way. And then if you're in trouble, you can help it to debug things. And really, this has been a great boon. It's saved many of us and others from falling into this pit of making a mistake in print that someone could then beat you about the head with in later life. And in a way, we need this, I think, in the single particle arena to objectively figure out whether or not you are dealing with the right symmetry at the moment. Because at the moment, it's a matter of choice. And when you read the paper, there's really nothing in them, usually, that prove one way or the other what it is. Anyway, I thought I'd say a little bit about that. And here is an example of its application. So this was a two-dimensional crystal of not bacteriorhodopsin, but halorhodopsin, which is the light-driven chloride pump from halobacteria. And Dieter Oesterhout and Wendy Havelka made these crystals about 10 years ago. And Wendy came to Cambridge and took pictures. And what this is the output from our image processing program, which doesn't need to know anything about space groups. You just take a little bit of the image and cross-correlate it with the rest of the image, find where all the unit cells are, straighten out the lattice, find out the amplitudes and phases of the diffraction spots. And then from the defocus, which is... it's not a very good picture, this one. So this is... it's got 1,400 angstroms of astigmatism, which is kind of typical if you're careful, but not very careful. So it's about half a micron defocus. And the circles are the positions of the zeros in the contrast transfer function. So if you look around the circle, you'll find that there are very few spots. And they're given these numbers. One means very strong. Four is the smallest, is the least strong that still gets a number. And then you go to sort of five, six, seven. Eight is a dot, and nines mean there's something there, but it's below the noise level. Can't even plot it. And you'll see the zeros, they're refined to fit it. But it doesn't tell you anything about the symmetry. But nevertheless, you can use the positions of the zeros to correct the phases of these by the transfer function. And then this program, AllSpace, takes these diffraction spots. It knows what the signal-to-noise ratio in each of the spots is, because it finds that by looking at it. And for example, a 1 means that the signal-to-noise ratio is more than 7. In other words, the peak is 7 times as big as the noise around it. By the time you're at a 7, which would be one of these here, the signal equals the noise. 8, the signal's less than the noise, and 9 is a sort of, act of faith. So anyway, AllSpace takes these phases and compares them, testing out any of the space groups that might have occurred. And obviously here you can see it's already been indexed. So we've looked at this diffraction pattern, and you can see that it's almost on a square lattice. And if you measure the cell dimensions, it looks square. So, for example, if you had indexed it by picking, this is the A-axis, H, you might have picked this as the B-axis. But because you look at it, it's got sort of MM symmetry, it looks square, it's more... So you can still make mistakes, but they're at a very sort of simplistic level now. You have to index it correctly. So the program, having been indexed on a square lattice, obviously it's unrealistic to expect the phases to agree as though they've been on a P3 lattice, because you'd have a 60 degree or 120 degree angle for that. So there are various ways it can compare them. So in fact, we stop. If you tell it you've got a square lattice, you don't look for the relationships between the phases that would be on a non-square lattice. But a square lattice might be fortuitously square, so that the cell dimension might be 100 angstroms in one direction and 105 in the other. Anyway, it looks at all the different space groups, it compares the phases of the reflections that ought to be related in that space group, and gives you a phase residual. So here would be, if you assume P2, you get a 42-degree phase residual. If you assume the next space group, and 90 degrees would be random here. But it also goes a bit further than that. It looks at the amplitude of the spots, and that was the signal-to-noise ratio, and it calculates, assuming that the phases in those spots are limited only by the random noise, what should the residual be? This is the target residual. So it should, in other words, if the crystal is indeed a P2 crystal with a twofold symmetry perpendicular to the membrane, that should be P2-1 really, then if your phase residual is 50 degrees or better, then within the accuracy of the data, the space group is P2. There's no arguing about it. There's no debate. It tells you. And the program gives you a little star if that's the case. So, but then if it's a higher symmetry, And you can look down here, and there's so P4212, which is actually the proper space group, we believe. You get a 28 degree phase residual, and actually, even if you've got it as high as, so they don't always agree exactly, but this is, if you like, a conservative one. If it's better than 37, then it is. So all of these space groups would be consistent with that, the data there. So the correct one, the highest symmetry, is P4212, but of course that includes P4, which means you've got a fourfold axis perpendicular, but it wouldn't have these others. And we've now run this on dozens of different data sets, and it really works quite well, actually, and it avoids you getting into trouble. And I just wanted to show you what happened in our case when we did get into trouble. So this on the left, this is actually the projection structure from the data in this picture, for example, or a few of these pictures averaged. And you can see that you've got the fourfold axis perpendicular to the membrane. We haven't drawn the twofold screws in, but the twofold screw would be here. So midway between a quarter of the cell, relating that tetramer, which is turned over by the screw and moved by half a cell. So these two are related by the screw. And there are also screws this way, and then the two folds are at 45 degrees. So that's P4212. But if you look at it sort of with your eyes half closed, you can see that that tetramer has some resemblance to this tetramer, except it's the opposite hand. This one goes anti-clockwise, this one goes clockwise. And if you go back to that picture, you'll see that at high resolution you have whole rows of spots here, but at low resolution every other one is weak or missing, and these are the ones that are strong. So when we first saw this, we didn't see these weak high resolution spots, and we indexed it on a lattice that was at 45 degrees to that lattice, and this was the projection that we got, and we interpreted it as the superposition of two membranes, and submitted the paper, and, you know, argued with the referees, and it was accepted. And this is what was going to be published. Wrong space group, wrong symmetry. You know, everything really was wrong, apart from the strong spots and the analysis. And actually, one of the referees, which turns out to have been Ken Downing, he said, well, he wasn't entirely convinced, and this ignoring these weak spots, you know, this would be a bad thing. But we thought, oh, well, we'll get it in press. And we were pretty sure the weak spots were some subtle rotation, a slight deviation from perfection, and we'd figure that out for the next paper. But, you know, about a week after the paper was accepted, we'd started on the next stage, and we discovered, actually, that it wasn't right. These weak spots in between, which you could hardly see, meant that instead of the lattice being 70 angstroms, it was 102 angstroms, but with a 45 degree, and that these tetramers were, it was a single membrane with alternate tetramers related to one another. But of course we didn't have this program then, and you know, it would have warned us to be, and we were just doing it by essentially guessing. And that's what a lot of people with single particles are doing now. They sort of look at it and they think, I think it's P4. And from then on, it's P4. You can't go back. And once you've got a model that's got symmetry, you can't extricate yourself from it. And it's very much the same. And actually, the same has been true in 3D crystals. There are wrong structures published. Anyway, so if you look at this a little bit more, and for comparison, this was the P3 bacteriorhodopsin. And the proteins are very, very similar. So the projection structure should look the same. So we put a circle around it, and you can see it's very, very similar here. Whereas this is the superposition. We've basically averaged that tetramer with that tetramer to make a smaller cell and averaged. But even if you look at this one here, you compare this projection to that projection, and then you compare this one, for example, to this one. If you look along the 45 degree direction, you see helix, 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 and then there are two very similar on either side. Whereas if you look at this same helix in bacteriodopsin, you go 1, 2, 3, and instead of this being bifurcated with an MM symmetry here, this one's fairly round, and then it sort of goes round. Whereas you look here, You go 1, 2, 3, and it's sort of still a bit bifurcated, although you have the bit sticking out here, and it's properly treated. So we actually think, and this wasn't a 3-angstrom crystal, it only went to about 4.5 or 5 angstroms, so we think that even though it is P4212, that some of these tetramers, which are very similar to one another, a few of them are in the wrong way up. And, you know, so you've got a crystal that's 90% P4212, but with the occasional tetramer in the wrong way. And you can carry on, you can collect data, and you know, and it all goes away in the refinement. And, you know, the same is true in X-ray. You get a bit of twinning, doesn't really matter, you know. No one mentions it, and everyone's fine. So, but this is one of the pitfalls in EM. I see I'm taking a bit longer here. There's only a few slides left. This is a mutant of Bacteriodopsin, which we were happily taking pictures of and processing. It's a sort of double mutant. And we would never have found this out had we not added to our image processing system an extra step, which is available. You don't need to do it. But the way we do image processing, you have your micrograph, you take a little bit out the middle, you cross-correlate it, you sort of straighten out the lattice, you fully transform it, you get the amplitudes and phases, you calculate a map. If you've got twinning, that means that instead of a single crystal, you've got little bits of crystals that are all lined up. You diffract it, you just get one spot. But parts of the crystal have twofold axes in, for example, flipping them. So in P3, Bacteriodopsin, part of it would be P3, you'd go a bit further over, there'd be a bit upside down. But all the molecules are lined up, the junction between the twin is parallel to one of the cell axes, and then in P3, you can also rotate it in the plane by 180 degrees, you can rotate it perpendicular, and then that can also be, so it's a four-way twin. And in crystallography, this is called tetartohedry. You have mirohedry, which is dimeric twinning, which is what the Pebe, Perula, and Landau and Rosenbusch crystals, they are perfectly mirohedrally twinned. These ones, which is a particular mutant, not very stable, turn out to be tetartohedrally twinning. Had we had these at the beginning, we'd have averaged it, and you've got a bit of a mess. You wouldn't have been able to interpret it in terms of the atoms. But what we've added now is, since we now have a model, instead of doing the cross-correlation between a bit of the image and the whole image, you can take an artificial projection from your model. So we have a little program now called MakeTran. It takes your model in a crystallographic environment and creates a micrograph from the theoretical model. And you can then cross-correlate your perfect model, which might have had hundreds of pictures creating it, from all angles. You can then cross-correlate that against your micrograph. And so you can put it in this way around, and that way around, and so on. And so these four parts are cross-correlations of this bit of a micrograph with each of the four-way tetartohedrally twinned versions. And what you can see is that most of the area consists of a single crystal. And the reason, I should also say, the reason it's got these kind of spots is this micrograph was taken with a spot scan method where you, instead of exposing the whole crystal at once on a bit of film, you're illuminating it with a succession of spots. And that cuts down some of the problems with charging and movement. But you know, the micrograph is the same. So what that shows is that this area of the crystal has the main orientation. However, other parts of the same membrane, so here, for example, coming out of this corner, there's a little bit that's been turned by 180. Here, that comes from here, and here is down here. And then there are bits of it in among it. And then down here, there's a fourth bit. And these are all four completely different. And if you don't cut them out and process them properly, you'd end up with a bit of a mess, actually. So it would be the average of all of them. So getting your space group right and making sure you haven't got twinning. And so this one, so both on the Halorhodopsin and on this mutant, we successfully avoided falling down the pit hole. But we did discover, actually, that a paper that, I should say, I was not a co-author of, but we ran a course in Cambridge in 1980, an image processing course. And we decided we needed to have a coarse specimen. And so we thought, well, we'll pick some cell wall, because there were lots of cell walls. No one had done 3D maps of them. We picked Sulfur Lobus cell wall. And we had all sorts of people taking pictures, and, you know, eventually there was enough data for a paper. And this is one by Ken Taylor, Linda Amos, and one other person. Say it again? No, no, it wasn't. It was Linda, Ken Taylor, Jim Dethridge. Anyway, they quite honorably, no one was doing anything. They came together for one summer for about 4 weeks and wrote a paper about it. And anyway, when that was analyzed and the structure was published, and it's a Nature, you know, it's quite a, you know, good paper. It was P6. The space group was P6. It was negatively stained. It was up to 85 degree tilts, you know, but it was averaged. About 10 years later, when some of the multivariate statistics, cross-correlation things in, Baumeister and the people in Munich, in fact, the specimen came from Munich. Hartmut Mickel brought it, and we thought it was a good one. It turned out it isn't P6, it's P3, and the twin areas are so small that you know, it was a mixture. So it was lots of P3s, and the twofold came from the twinning. And so actually the structure is not badly wrong, but it's wrong. And it should have been P3, and we should have found that. And I'm sure out there in literature there are dozens of other papers that are wrong. Let me just try and bring this to a conclusion. All right, so there are two last slides. One was, so this is now comparing to X-ray. And this is a picture of about half a dozen of the something like 18 or 20 sets of bacteriorhodopsin coordinates that are published now and in the database. And two of them are from electron microscopy, which is from our work and from Yoshi Fujiyoshi's work. And four of them are from X-ray structures. And you can see that the bits in the membrane are very, very similar. And the parts that differ most are the loop regions. Particularly, there are three loops that are somewhat disordered. And in some cases, they're so disordered, even in the 3D X-ray crystals, that the people haven't deposited the coordinates. So I think if you look up here, there are six loops here, but there are only five loops here. So one of the groups has just left out a bit of this because it was, you know, it was too difficult to build. And so different parts of the structure are more disordered. And the one that we think we didn't do terribly well, but actually it's not very well ordered in the crystals, this was our blue one here, which sort of differs from, but of course all the others differ as well. So there are parts that do differ between structures, and they're real, and they probably don't matter, but, you know, nevertheless, you want to do the best you can. So it is, I think, very valuable to do structures more than once, particularly if there are different space groups, and then to compare them and to track down the differences. And then I did want to show, and I'm sure Jeff will, this is Chris Tate's EMRE work. And this is Chris Tate's crystal structure. It's not at high resolution. It's going to be hard to do it at very high resolution, but there are a lot of groups working on this, not a lot, a few. So we do think this would be a good one to go to high resolution because it diffracts well and it forms a number of 2D crystals and a number of groups have 3D crystals. And one of the things you may not get in 2D crystallography is such high resolution, 2 angstroms or 1.5 angstroms. But it does have a sort of lipid environment, and so I think it's a useful way of testing against it. Okay, and then, well, that's going to be my last slide. So this is the second last one. Sorry, we're... So this is, I'm not... There are lots of other things I could have put in to discuss. And I thought I'd just mention a few things that I think are useful things that are worth discussing for the future. The things that we're doing at the moment, or have done, and we think are quite important, in the 2D electron crystallography, the big difference between, say, getting to 6 or 7 angstroms, which is, for example, this EMRE structure, a lot of the other structures in that table, it's quite easy to get to 6 or 7 angstroms, quite quick, and not too risky or difficult. But to go from there to high resolution, a number of other, you need bigger crystals, they need to be well ordered, you need to get them flat, you need to get high tilts and so on. And the thing that we found to be the biggest step is we wrote some programs which take care of the fact that if you have a crystal that's tilted, the defocus changes by perhaps a micron. If it's a 45 or a 60 degree tilt, a half micron area that you're trying to average will be either a half or a 1 micron focus difference. And so a particular Fourier component, as you go across the crystal, for example, a 4 angstrom spot, the contrast transfer function formula goes as delta F, the defocus, times theta squared. So at a particular diffraction angle, as the defocus varies, the contrast changes as a sine wave. And you can easily have 20 variations of contrast across your micrograph, plus minus 10 times, say. And so you've got to correct for that. And the only time you don't need it is if you've got a very small crystal, low resolution or not very high tilt. So as soon as you've got a big crystal, high resolution, high tilt, you need it. And so a very good test is when you switch the image processing of the 2D crystal between a sort of simple-minded way of doing it, 1D focus, no correction for transfer function and so on, to use these programs that do the tilt transfer function correction, which are TT-Box, TT-Refine, TT-Mask. There is a little group of three. Unless you get a better result after you do this tilt transfer function correction, you haven't really got a hope of going to high resolution. And so that's quite a big step forward in a simple test. A second thing that we found to be a big success, which was that tetrahedral training I showed you, is that once you've got a model, you're better off to use that model to find out where all your unit cells are. And that's a little program called, which makes a transform, makes a micrograph with a particular defocus from a model. And again, you can use that to bootstrap your way, improve the image processing, improve the model, improve the image processing, and so on. And that's made quite a difference. For example, I think the first paper that was published that was Vincent Unger's work with Mark Jaeger here on the gap junctions, and that's been used in a number of other things. And then the third thing is, obviously, when we're doing cross-correlating to find where the crystal is, you use a certain size of reference. And at the moment, we're using quite a number of unit cells, 20, 30, 100 unit cells. So the molecular weight of the bit of this crystal that's being used to explore where the rest of the crystal is 25, 50, 100 unit cells. So it might be 1 million, 2 million molecular weight. So if you like, you can think of our current way of doing two-dimensional image processing as doing single particles with something like 1 or 2 million molecular weight reference object. And really, we'd like to bring that down. You ought to be able to bring it down. And we have tried with the very best images that we have to drop the size of the reference box so that instead of it being the average of a number of unit cells, so that you're using the intrinsic crystallinity as part of your process, you drop it to 1 unit cell. So you're doing essentially single particle work. And it works, but the results are not as good. So doing this crystallographic approach, in the best cases, is 10 or 20 times better than treating it as single particles. But eventually, it ought not to be. If the images are good enough, you ought to be able to do it properly. So these are three things that we do and that we give attention to and are key factors in judging whether you're doing well or not. Why are we not doing better? Well, these are three problems we think. For example, the images we get, and I'll talk about this more tomorrow, they really are very bad images. They should be better when you calculate it, but they're not. When you do tilted micrographs, but it affects the untilted ones equally, it's quite difficult to make crystals flat. They're only 1 unit cell. The great thing about a 3D crystal, it's a three-dimensional object. It's got built-in cross-links, so it is flatter. If we had better micrographs, you could reprogram some of the steps to treat different regions to take into consideration the tilt, and then it would simply be you'd be extracting the data properly. And at the moment, we get around that by throwing away bad pictures. The bad pictures ought to have as much data in as the good ones, and they're thrown away at the moment. And then, essentially, the third point is the same as the last one here. Although at the moment we optimize, we ought one day to be able to treat them as single molecules, and then disordered crystals instead of just doing an XY correction, you could do an orientation correction, maybe in the other directions. And then you'd have been able to rescue structures at the moment which fade out at 7 angstroms. Those same micrographs, perhaps, ought to have the data in that go to higher resolution, but we're just not extracting it at the moment. And then the last thing is, we know it's important to do a defocus and astigmatism correction, and you can see we're doing it to an angstrom. You probably only need it to 50 or 100 angstroms. And you've got 1,000, 1,500 angstroms of astigmatism. Most of the single particle work, so this is lessons from 2D, to be applied in other areas, helical processing, single particle processing, and so on. Most of the people are simply, they do defocus correction, but not astigmatism correction. That's obviously quite important and makes a big difference at high resolution. But we also, and we've been doing this for 20 years, we do beam tilt, and because we're indexing the spots, if your micrograph has a 1% difference in magnification in two orthogonal directions, and we've measured our microscopes, and they can be worse than that, if you've got a 1% difference in magnification, a 100 angstrom object will be 101 angstroms, and there's no way you can get 3 or 4 angstrom resolution without correcting for that. The 2D crystallography and the helical one, because of the way you index it, sort of automatically takes that out. So these are two things that we know, nobody's programming them, and therefore no one can get to 4 angstroms. There may be other reasons as well, like the images are bad. So there are a whole range of things that are sort of midway between computational, experimental, but they're all technical, that you need to consider alongside the biology and the biochemistry. Okay, and then the last thing is a sort of lead-in. We had a great deal of fun doing this. Tim Baker and I wrote this little review for International Tables for Crystallography, Volume F. Goes up to, you know, Z soon. But we specially picked things neither of us had ever worked on. And they were meant to be, you know, representatives of the best people had done. And this is Werner Kuhlbrandt's LHC 2D crystal, using more or less the approaches I've been talking about. This is a beautiful picture Ron made, and as far as I know, I haven't seen it published anywhere else, but I bet you it, you know, ought to be. But this is a summary of all. This is actin and yes. And I don't know if it is, but, you know, it's just micrographs. Tony Crowther and Bettina Botcher, and this is still one of the highest resolution single particle dicosahedral. And then this is Joachim Frank's, who's just about to come out then, an 11.5 angstrom resolution structure of the 70S, which was a single particle with no symmetry, with symmetry, helical and 2D crystal. And actually, you know, all of the micrographs at the top are essentially taken under the same sort of conditions, the same microscope, but each of the image processing systems are completely different. So there's a degree of commonality, and I'll come back to this, you know, couple of days, but tomorrow I'll talk about single particles. So anyway, sorry I've taken you longer than lunch. Anyway.